Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast.
Good Monday morning. It's the show. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix with Mark Brody. We're joined by the Takeaway's Todd Zwillick as well this morning. Coming up, we'll preview the U.S. Supreme Court term, and we'll find out how Houston is recovering from hurricane damage. As we've been hearing this morning, a gunman opened fire into a crowd at a country music festival in Las Vegas last night, resulting in what is currently being called the worst shooting in American history. Officials have now confirmed at least 50 people are dead and more than 400 sent to local hospitals.
The first reported shots came just after 10 p.m. as thousands of people attended the last day of the Route 91 music festival. Officials say the gunman shot down onto the crowd from the 32nd floor of the hotel, sending people running from the grounds. Early this morning, police in Las Vegas identified the shooter.
His name is Stephen Paddock. Last name spelled P-A-D-D-O-C-K. With the date of birth of 4-9 of 1953.
He's a 64-year-old from Mesquite, Nevada.
We located numerous firearms within the room that he occupied, and that's, like I stated earlier, it's going to be a long and tedious investigation.
And in the last 90 minutes or so, President Trump made a statement from the White House.
I want to thank the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department and all of the first responders for their courageous efforts and for helping to save the lives of so many. The speed with which they acted is miraculous and prevented further loss of life.
And joining us now is Adam Candy, assistant editor at the Las Vegas Sun. Adam, thanks for being with us on a difficult morning.
I'm happy to join you.
So what additionally, if anything, do we know other than sort of what we've been hearing already this morning?
Well, I think the question everyone immediately goes to is the motive of the shooter, and the most recent briefing from the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department did not shed any additional light on that. Obviously, you've seen the updated numbers in terms of 58 who've passed away and 515 victims. Beyond that, we know that the Metropolitan Police Department is going to be clearing the crime scene for at least another 12 hours and that they have discovered another property belonging to Stephen Paddock in northern Nevada that they are going to search today in further hopes of determining a motive.
Las Vegas is obviously a city which hosts a lot of visitors. How are people responding? Like, what are you and what are your colleagues hearing from folks who either were at the concert or maybe just people in the city?
Well, our Las Vegas Sun team has been on the strip since 10 p.m. Last night when these first reports came in, and I think it's what you would expect. It's panic, it's chaos, it's fear. There are some folks who are starting to come back to the hotels now that have been reopened, and I think that what you're getting from a lot of them is shock and numbness. Beyond that, I feel like the locals in Las Vegas are really only starting to wake up to this news now. You know, it's a tourism-dependent economy in Las Vegas, and there's always been a great fear that an event like this would take place, and unfortunately, it appears to have come true.
Is there a sense that the location of this on the Strip, which is sort of the, you know, the most recognizable part of Las Vegas, any potential worry of copycat kinds of crimes or any worry about, you know, something else maybe going on over there?
I think that's probably a worry with any of these situations. I would point to the methodology and the apparent planning of the shooter to have found an outdoor gathering of more than 20,000 people in which he fired what appeared to be very, very high-powered weapons from a hotel that has no balconies. He had to use a hammer type device to break out the window and be able to shoot. And for the reference of your listeners in the Valley, This is a very long distance. Mandalay Bay is across Las Vegas Boulevard and set a good distance back from the Strip. And this is a empty desert site that is used for concerts like the festival, for iHeartRadio Festival, for the American Ninja Warrior Finals. This required a significant amount of planning that I think at least lessens the fear of that copycat tech.
What is the scene right now on the Strip? It's obviously a place where there are always a good number of people. What does it look like right now?
Right now, what you're starting to see is people making their way back. Many of the folks who had escaped the festival and who were just on the Strip at the time were taken to an evacuation site at the Thomas and Mack Center, which is where the UNLV college basketball team plays, has about an 18,000-seat arena where folks were staging at that point. And they're being bused back to their hotels starting at around 3 or 4 a.m. Those casinos began to open again. They were letting people out. Only hotel guests were allowed to go back in. So I think the scene, to answer your question, is still a great deal of shock. And I think people are only starting to come to grips with what happened.
All right. That's Adam Candy, the assistant editor at the Las Vegas Sun. Adam, thanks a lot for being with us this morning. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on.
Danita Cohen is a spokesperson at University Medical Center in Las Vegas. Danita, thank you for being here.
You're welcome.
Describe the scene, if you would, at your emergency room in your hospital overnight.
A level one trauma center. We're the only level one trauma center in the state of Nevada. Our trauma center is completely separate and self-contained from our emergency department. And in the trauma center, we received upwards of 30 patients. 12 of those patients were critically injured. 8 of those patients went directly to the OR. We have 3 OR suites within our trauma center, so they don't have to leave and go to other parts of the hospital. That area is all self-contained. We did have, unfortunately, 4 patients pass away. The good news is we have already had several patients who have been treated and released.
And how many patients admitted to your emergency room, your separate emergency room at the hospital?
Well, we had 30 patients in our trauma center, so the rest of the 104 went to our emergency department. We also did have included in that 104 2 teenagers, and those patients went to our children's hospital because they're under the age of 18.
Can you paint a picture of the scene as this many patients poured in sort of all at once after this shooting?
Sure. Well, being the level one trauma center, this is what we are here for. And so our trauma team is trained to treat and stabilize mass numbers of patients. Now, 104 patients all at one time, that is way more than we have ever seen. However, our teams were fully ready. And we operate on accordion staffing. So we had our regular trauma team who was in-house 24/7 around the clock. And then because we operate under accordion staffing, as we needed more trauma surgeons and ICU nurses and critical care nurses and other clinicians, they came in. Everybody from our CEO down to extra environmental service workers came in to help us. And those patients were being triaged right at the door. So they didn't even come into the trauma center. They were triaged out in the ambulance bay.
There were reports that at a certain point, the call went out to divert patients away from your hospital because it was at capacity and some patients were taken to other facilities.
So being the level one trauma center, we never turn trauma patients away. However, in these sorts of mass casualty incidents, we do triage patients so that we are receiving the most critically injured patients at the trauma center. And those who are less injured or might just need emergency services can be seen at other hospitals, which saves our resources for the critically injured.
Danita Cohen, has your facility, your trauma center, or your ER ever seen an event like this?
The last time we had a mass casualty incident, you might remember that we had the woman who drove onto the Las Vegas Strip a few years ago. And from that incident, we had about 17 patients who came into our trauma center. This many patients is unheard of. I've heard reports it's the largest mass casualty shooting in U.S. history. But we were here. We were ready to take care of as many patients as needed us this evening and into the early morning hours now.
And you mentioned 12 people still in critical condition. Is that right?
Correct. And those patients are throughout our different ICUs. We have several ICUs, a trauma intensive care unit and medical intensive care units. And so they have been appropriately placed with ICU care, meaning that they could have a one-on-one ratio, one nurse to one patient taking care of them.
Danita Cohen, we appreciate you taking the time to join us.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Danita Cohen, spokesperson at University Medical Center in Las Vegas, where more than 100 patients were taken after the shooting outside the Mandalay Bay Hotel last night.
That's Todd Zwillick at our partner, The Takeaway, and you're listening to the show. The U.S. Supreme Court's 2017-18 term officially opened today, and it's Justice Neil Gorsuch's first full term as a member of the court. Gorsuch's presence has the court on what has been its typical makeup in recent years: four members considered conservative, four who are on the liberal side, and Justice Anthony Kennedy, who's considered to be the resident swing vote. As always, the court will be considering a number of huge issues. This term, those topics include redistricting, religious liberty, gay rights, and whistleblowing. And with me to preview the High Court's new term is Vincent Bonventri, professor at Albany Law School and the man behind the blog New York Court Watcher. Now, Vin, many have said that Justice Neil Gorsuch has a lot in common with former Justice Scalia when it comes to how he'll decide cases, just with a different temperament. What do you think of that?
That's right. I think if you're politically conservative, you have good reason to be optimistic, because Neil Gorsuch, like you said, shares much of the same jurisprudence as Justice Scalia. On the other hand, he doesn't seem to be nearly as nasty as Scalia. In fact, he seems to be a very cordial gentleman. And not only that, I mean, he has a way of writing that it doesn't seem as his views don't seem nearly as extreme. But if you track his record, both on the appellate court and even just in the 2.5 short months while he was on the United States Supreme Court last term, it's pretty clear that, in fact, he's at least as politically conservative as Justice Scalia. He's already voted in death penalty, on death penalty matters, gun rights, gay rights, worker rights. And his record at the circuit court as an appellate judge was completely accurate as a predictor of how he was going to vote, exactly as you would expect a political conservative to vote on all of those issues.
So the Supreme Court at this point is back to 4-4 with Justice Kennedy,
With Justice Kennedy, that right. The other thing, though, to look for is not only, okay, Gorsuch, will he continue to be the very politically conservative judge he was on the circuit court and as he was for his first 2.5 months on the United States Supreme Court? But what about the Chief Justice? I mean, the Chief Justice certainly is giving indications of moderating, because he's clearly a political conservative. But there have been cases which show that he is moderating. In fact, if you just look at the last 2.5 months of the United States Supreme Court's last term with Gorsuch on it, Gorsuch is so extreme that in those cases in which Gorsuch participated, the Chief Justice was 50-50, voting with the liberals as opposed to voting with the conservatives. 50-50. So it may be that Gorsuch, his votes and his record will be so extreme that it might push the Chief Justice over to the left a bit. That has happened before with other justices.
And Vin, wanted to go over a couple of specific specific cases with you. One is actually going to be argued in the first week, at least scheduled to be argued the first week when the court opens, and that's Gill versus Whitford, which has to do with redistricting in Wisconsin. Now, here in Arizona, we have an independent redistricting commission.
Yes.
Very few states have that. How impactful do you think this sort of case could be?
Well, it could be very, very impactful. With regard to the Gill v. Whitford case, that comes out of Wisconsin. And what happened in Wisconsin was that the Republican legislature, and I don't want to put a pox on Republicans because Democrats do the same darn thing when they're in power. But in this case, it was the Republicans in Wisconsin that you know that they carved up legislative districts within the state to almost ensure that Republicans were going to win the majority, even if the voters vote for a majority of Democrats. You know, that happens in the United States generally anyway. You know, you'll have the Democrats will actually win the majority of votes when you have votes for, say, the House of Representatives. But nevertheless, the Republicans win most of the House of Representatives seats because of all the gerrymandering going on. The question really is, although we know that race-based gerrymandering, trying to discriminate on the basis of race to dilute the voting power of African Americans, we know that's unconstitutional. The question is, what about political gerrymandering, whereas one political party that's in power does everything it can to dilute the power of the other political party?
I'll bring in the political term of wedge issue. Are there any that really fit that mold, that really are more about the politics of right versus left as opposed to what makes sense legally?
Yes, and that, of course, is the Masterpiece Cake Shop case. And you have a baker who has refused to create, you know, wedding cakes for same-sex marriages. There are a few twists in that case. First of all, with regard to same-sex couples, the United States Supreme Court seemed to make it pretty clear in the Obergefell case, where it said that same-sex couples had the right to marry. And then subsequently, last term, where the United States Supreme Court invalidated what Arkansas was doing in discriminating against same-sex couples on the birth certificates of their children. The United States Supreme Court has made it pretty clear that same-sex couples are entitled to the same benefits as opposite-sex couples with regard to marriage. On the other hand, you have religious liberty, especially when you have religious qualms against same-sex marriage. That's a serious violation of free exercise of religion for these individuals to be forced into accommodating, facilitating, aiding, and abetting same-sex marriages. So you have a real conflict between, you know, gay rights, same-sex couple rights, and religious liberty. So that's a biggie. That's a real biggie.
Vincent Bonventri is the Justice Jackson Distinguished Professor of Law at Albany Law School. Vin, always great to catch up. Thank you.
Oh, it's great to talk to you, Steve. Thank you.
Leaders in Catalonia are meeting today to try to figure out their next steps after Sunday's referendum, in which they say 90% of voters cast ballots in favor of independence from Spain. That's just one of the major events happening this week on the international stage. With me for our weekly look at some of them is the BBC's Rich Preston. And Rich, the election led to violence in Spain yesterday, as Spanish authorities said the vote was illegal. Catalan officials say voters back secession with a 42% turnout. What happens next?
Well, Mark, Spain's justice minister said they're prepared to use the full force of the Spanish constitution. That includes suspending the degree of autonomy that the Catalan region already has. Catalan authorities, on the other hand, have said they will deliver what the people have voted for. Alfred Bosch is leader of the Republican Left Party in the Barcelona City Council. He spoke to the BBC earlier today.
This means that since the yes vote won, then we have to go forward to proclaim the Catalan Republic. And in any case, if force, brutal force, was exerted against the voters, our conclusion is that if this was a justified move, it's even more justified now that ordinary citizens have been brutalized in that way.
Now, separatists had originally said there would be a hard split from Spain within 48 hours. But at a press conference today, the Catalan separatist Carles Puigdemont pedaled back on that somewhat and instead said that he wanted talks with Spain's Prime Minister Mariano Rajoy. Now, the Catalan leader also said his administration has begun legal action to hold Spain's national police to account for the violence during yesterday's vote. As well as that, more than 40 trade unions and Catalan associations have called a strike tomorrow, Tuesday, because of what they call the grave violation of rights and freedoms. But, Mark, there's a bigger picture here as well. European leaders were widely quiet on the issue of Catalan's independence vote. Nearly all EU countries turned a blind eye. Now, remember, there are choppy waters in Europe at the moment. The Brexit vote, the migrant crisis, terror attacks. And that silence around the vote could be seen as European politeness. But I spoke to our diplomatic correspondent, James Landale, earlier on today, and he told me there's a lot more to it than that.
First of all, many EU nations fear that if Catalonia won its independence, then that would encourage other separatist movements in their own countries. Secondly, I think there's a question of consistency. The EU has opposed independence for, say, the Kurds. And third, and I think perhaps most importantly, the EU is just fundamentally opposed to separatist movements in principle. Having one member state suddenly divide into two would create huge problems for officials in Brussels.
Now, Europe has come out broadly in support of the Spanish government and it's urged both sides to talk to each other. But this story will run on for weeks. It's the biggest political crisis Spain has seen in decades.
So, Rich, in Zurich, Switzerland this week, the Europe-Iran Forum is taking place. What's going on here?
Well, Mark, this forum has been in place for 4 years and it's part of the Iran nuclear deal. There are four European co-signatories: Britain, France, Germany and Russia. And this is about helping Europe and Iran develop trade relationships after the sanctions against Iran were lifted in 2016. So top business leaders there from both sides getting to know each other and developing links. Now, for Iran, this is important because President Hassan Rouhani's reputation depends on improving the economic fortunes of Iranians. For Europe, this is about new business and new markets. But that doesn't mean it'll be easy. I spoke this morning to our Arab Affairs editor, Sebastian Usher.
There are many issues in Iran, human rights issues and so on, that affect any political dialogue, any business dialogue. But essentially, Europe is very much behind the deal. It has, as far as Europeans are concerned, appeared to be working.
But Mark, there's a big cloud hanging over this week's event, the United States. Now, as we know, President Trump is not a fan of the Iran nuclear deal. And if the US walks, the sanctions against Iran go back in place and business arrangements stop. That's not what European leaders want, and that's not what President Rouhani wants either. So that Europe-Iran forum takes place tomorrow, Tuesday.
And finally, Rich, Nobel Week has kicked off in Stockholm. The prize in physiology was awarded to three American scientists for their work on the human body clock. The week ends, though, on Friday with the announcement of arguably the most famous of the Nobel Prizes, the Nobel Peace Prize. What should we be watching out for?
Well, Mark, a bit of history for you to begin with. These awards were created by Alfred Nobel, a Swedish scientist, and the first Nobel Prizes were announced in 1901. They're all given out in Stockholm, in Sweden, with the exception of the Nobel Peace Prize, which is handed out in Norway's capital, Oslo. But Nobel Prize winners are often controversial. Last year's Literature Prize, you may remember, went to Bob Dylan. That was lauded by many and ridiculed by some. In 2010, the Nobel Peace Prize went to the Chinese dissident Liu Xiaobo. That prompted Beijing to impose a six-year diplomatic freeze with Norway at great cost to the country. Lars Bevenga is our reporter in Oslo, covering the Peace Prize announcement on Friday, and he's been looking ahead to who's in the running. It's a story you might be familiar with.
This year's top contender for the Peace Prize is the team behind the Iran nuclear deal. Nobel observers argue this would fit perfectly with Alfred Nobel's desire for the prize to go to those who've done the most to promote the fraternity between nations and reduce standing armies. Others, like the current US president, will no doubt disagree.
So, Mark, as you say, the Physiology Medicine Award was given out today. Physics is given out tomorrow. On Wednesday, it's the Chemistry Prize, then that all-important Peace Prize on Friday.
Big announcement for the end of the week we'll be keeping our eyes on. That's the BBC's Rich Preston. Rich, a pleasure as always to talk to you. Thanks.
Good to talk to you, Mark. Thank you.
And on this Monday, you're listening to the show. A group of Democrats in Congress is trying to put a stop to President Trump's pardon of former Maricopa County Sheriff Joe Arpaio. Arpaio was convicted of criminal contempt of court for disobeying a judge's order to end racial profiling of Latinos. He could have been sentenced to serve up to a year in prison.
The group filed an amicus brief with the court last week, asking Judge Susan Bolton to reject the pardon on legal grounds. Former Arizona Attorney General Terry Goddard is one of the lawyers behind this brief, and he's on the line with us now to tell us more about it. Good morning, Terry.
Good morning.
So what is the argument you're making here?
Well, basically, it boils down, and let me be clear, this is an argument that we are asking the court to take a look at, but it's up to the judge as to whether they even want to submit any amicus or look at any amicus briefs in this case, which is going to be heard on Wednesday of this week. But basically, what this brief on behalf of 33 congressmen says is that there are separation of powers. That's a critical part of the constitutional scheme in the United States. And a big part of the ability of the judges, the judiciary, to do their job depends upon their ability to find a defendant if they abuse or if they violate court orders, to find them in contempt. So by taking away the contempt power, what the president has done, in essence, is violated the separation of powers in the U.S. constitutional scheme.
Is that, in your mind, what separates this pardon from maybe other pardons that other presidents have issued?
I think so. It is a very different cat. Usually pardons, which is an important part of presidential powers, we don't dispute that, have to do with ameliorating an injustice, what is seen as a sentence that is unduly harsh or under the circumstances should be either set aside or reduced. And that's what presidents have done throughout history. This is different. There hasn't been a sentence imposed. There hasn't been a penalty yet. And this goes directly to the powers of the courts, not just to apply penalties, but to do their business, to be able to keep order, to be able to make sure that somebody, a defendant who comes before the court, actually is required to obey their orders. And so that's a fundamental power under the Constitution the judiciary has, and the executive has no business interfering with that particular power.
Now, Terry, precedent is what makes the courts go around in many ways. Is there precedent for an argument like this being accepted by courts in the past?
Well, it is within the discretion of the court. So, yes, courts, district courts can accept the argument, or it's completely in their discretion. They can say, no, we're not going to take it. We're not going to file, you know, what we applied for, and other individuals or groups looking to put arguments before the court have basically, because they're not parties, they have asked for leave from the court to make the argument. Now, that's up to Judge Bolton as to whether or not that will be granted.
Do you have any expectation of when you might hear? I mean, is that something that could be decided in a couple of days?
Well, it better be decided before they have the hearing on the underlying case, which is 10 o'clock on Wednesday. So whether or not she's going to take a look at it will be resolved before then. But the basic reason for that hearing was that the Justice Department asked to have the whole decision by the court to hold the sheriff in contempt set aside. And the judge came back and said, wait a minute, show us some precedent. Show us some cases that say that is appropriate. And they could not find any. So she said, well, come back and give me some better reference. So that's what gave other people, other parties, other interested parties the opportunity to do this kind of amicus argument.
All right. That's former Arizona Attorney General Terry Goddard. Terry, thanks for your time. Good to talk to you.
Thank you. Take care.
It's only been 2 weeks since Hurricane Harvey ravaged Houston, Texas, and the surrounding region, dumping more than 40 inches of rain on some areas, causing catastrophic flooding. Since then, disasters have hit South Florida and Costa Rica. But how is the nation's fourth largest city coping with the recovery? The show's Lauren Gilger is here with an update. Good morning, Lauren.
Good morning. So in the weeks since the storm, there has been a lot of environmental fallout as the EPA confirmed fears that the San Jacinto waste pits were damaged and they're leaking toxic chemicals into the watershed. And the city has grappled with the question of whether some homeowners should be able to rebuild in flood-prone areas. I caught up with Lisa Olson. She's an investigative reporter with the Houston Chronicle earlier this morning to get an update on what's happening on the ground in Texas.
For some neighborhoods, life is definitely back to normal, but there are other neighborhoods that remained piled with debris where most of the homes are gutted. And so you have people in various types of difficulty because of that. You have some people facing financial ruin. You have some people who have insurance who are getting their homes inspected and preparing to rebuild. You have some people who are struggling to decide what they're going to do. They don't have enough money to rebuild, or maybe they don't have permission to rebuild because of where they live.
Right. And you've also been reporting on a lawsuit against the Army Corps of Engineers saying they should compensate homeowners whose property was flooded with reservoir pools. Can you fill us in on what's going on there?
Well, there are approximately 4,000 people in the western part of the city and also a few thousand more northwest who were flooded intentionally by the Army Corps of Engineers, who allowed the reservoir pools to back up in their properties to avoid releasing too much out of our dams, which would have caused more catastrophic flooding in the city, the center of the city. Most of those people had no idea they were in reservoir pools, so I've been reporting on the fact that that wasn't disclosed to most of them when they bought their homes. And those people, many of them didn't have flood insurance because they had no idea they were at risk of flooding. They're not in the, many of them are not in the floodplain. So that's a component, that's a subset of the people who are in that desperate strait of having to rebuild and trying to figure out what to do. Many of them do not have insurance.
Yeah, that's an outstanding example of this. But in general, did all of the people who needed it have flood insurance here?
No, they. A lot of people did not have flood insurance for various reasons. Some people forwent flood insurance because they wanted to save money, but there are plenty of others who weren't actually in a 100-year floodplain who didn't, or who financed their own homes or who owned their own homes, mm-hmm. who just didn't have it. So, yeah, we have. Even though Houston has more a history of a lot of flood claims for many years, and you could argue that everyone here should have had it, there are plenty of people who didn't. I think what was interesting to me about the flood pool folks is they clearly had a risk of flooding, but they didn't know about.
Yeah.
And, you know, the people who didn't buy flood insurance who live in the floodplain, you know, they knew they were running a big risk. These people had no idea they were running a big risk.
Right, right. And also last week, a big story came out that the EPA confirmed that one of the most vulnerable Superfund sites there, the San Jacinto waste pits, was damaged in this. What's the fallout looking like from that?
Well, it's a really horrible situation. We had 13 Superfund sites in Texas flooded that the EPA said were possibly damaged. But the one that neighborhood residents were most concerned about from the beginning and one we wrote about very early on were the San Jacinto waste pits, which originally were on the banks of the river. The paper mill waste for many years were stored there, and they contained dioxin, which is one of the most potent human carcinogens. The floodwaters that hit that were deep and strong, and lots of debris washed into the neighborhood right around those sites. And one of the residents flew a drone over during the storm to show how violent the river was raging mm-hmm. over those sites. So they've been concerned now for a month that dioxin's leaking. And yes, the EPA just confirmed that they were correct. The EPA has been very secretive and has been saying, you know, that they didn't think there was any damage. And so this is a terrible confirmation of a worst fear that not only affects hundreds and thousands of people who live in neighborhoods up and down that area, but also the people who care about our watershed. That's one of our biggest bodies of water in Houston. That's one of the main rivers that leads into the Galveston Bay and then empties into the Gulf of Mexico. And dioxin from that site's already poisoned fish and made fish inedible for children and pregnant women. So we're looking at a potential disaster, depending on how far it's spread.
Wow. So obviously there are all of these environmental consequences. From a human level, and as a Houstonian, what is it that you are seeing happening? Are you seeing the community come together as part of this recovery, or is this going to be a really tough struggle for a long time?
Well, certainly you saw people come together during the storm, as they have in past storms, to help each other. Houstonians are generous people, and people are helping their neighbors as much as they can. Like I said, a lot of people are living with their neighbors. A lot of people were rescued by their neighbors. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, people are generous, but recovery it takes a long time. It can take months to rebuild a house, especially when you can't get permission from your bank or your insurance company, or even know if you have permission to rebuild on your site. So the federal regulations and what they're going to be trying to decide about Houston going forward is going to determine in part the pace of recovery. Mm-hmm. Clearly, building again on really flood-prone areas is probably a bad idea, but there's not enough money to buy out everybody. How many people can move? How many people can stay? And what can be done? These are the answers we're looking for right now.
All right. Lisa Olson is an investigative reporter for the Houston Chronicle. Lisa, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
Residents of Houston and Florida's Gulf Coast are still in the early stages of cleaning up after Hurricanes Harvey and Irma, and public health officials are warning residents to be aware of the possibility of an increase in certain diseases as a result of the flooding. With me to talk about that is Dr. Peter Hotez, Dean of the National School of Tropical Medicine at Baylor College of Medicine in Houston. And Dr. Hotez, on the list of concerns after a natural disaster like this, where does the spread of disease come?
The truth is, we haven't really been monitoring hurricanes as closely as we should. You know, what we've really learned the most from probably are the events after Katrina. So a lot of what we're anticipating that's already happened and going to be happening after Harvey and Irma and Maria, we're kind of looking at lessons learned from Katrina and as best we can trying to better understand what's going to happen after that.
Is the concern mostly that there are obviously large standing pools of water, which is a place that mosquitoes and other insects can breed? Are there other factors that lead into the potential spread of illnesses?
Sure. So what we're now starting to see are kind of the immediate aftermath effects and then the longer term implications. So in the immediate aftermath, for instance, in Harvey, what you have are individuals who've been directly exposed to floodwaters. We've had this unprecedented rain event here in Houston where some 27 trillion gallons of water fell over a couple of days. And people who have had contact with floodwaters have had increase in diarrheal disease. We've seen an uptick in upper respiratory infections and also diarrheal disease. And also an interesting number of skin infections, what some people are calling flesh-eating wound infections from a unique type of Vibrio bacteria that we have here in the Gulf. And then as the floodwaters start to recede, it leaves behind lots of standing water. And with that, you have a sharp increase in the number of mosquitoes. They include nuisance mosquitoes that can still transmit dog heartworm disease. But the one we're probably worrying about the most right now in after Harvey, a little bit different in Puerto Rico, but in Harvey, we're worried about an increase in West Nile virus infection.
Is it a challenge to try to get people treated when they are sort of spread out? They're either in evacuation centers or maybe staying with friends or family. It might be harder to reach people and harder for people to know what health centers are open and available to people.
Yeah, it is a challenge to convey public health messages. You know, we do a very good job here in Houston. We actually have two parallel health departments that do different but overlapping things, a Harris County Health Department and a Houston City Health Department, and they're doing an excellent job. The problem is across the United States, not many people realize this, but public health control happens at the county or district level. So while Harris County is a very strong player, other counties in Texas might not be as well staffed or equipped, and so things are very heterogeneous here on the Gulf Coast.
Is there anything that can be done to try to prevent some of these diseases from cropping up? I mean, as you said, you know, trillions of gallons of water fell on your city. It's almost impossible to say to somebody, just don't come into contact with floodwater. I mean, it seems like it would be an impossibility. So is there anything that health officials or people can do to try to stave some of the stuff off?
Yeah, sure. Certainly, when it comes to mosquito-transmitted virus infections, we're particularly worried about West Nile virus infection. It would rely on trying to limit exposure to mosquito bites. So staying indoors for the next few weeks as much as you can. Also, if you need to be out and about to use insect repellents that contain DEET, there's both a good news and a bad news story to the mosquito transmission virus story. So as we move over the next few weeks, things will cool down and the amount of mosquito transmission will decrease as we move throughout the month of October. What is interesting, though, more than a decade ago when the health effects of Katrina were looked at, it was noticed there was another big uptick in West Nile virus infection the following year, in 2006. So we're also going to be prepared for the fact that we could see a big increase next year. And, of course, the other thing besides West Nile is when Katrina hit back in 2005, We did not have Zika or chikungunya in the Western Hemisphere. Now we do. So those are two other mosquito-transmitted virus infections that we're going to have to look out for.
I was going to ask you for how long health officials sort of need to be on the lookout for this stuff. It sounds like it's not a short-term thing.
Definitely not. Certainly for the next year, we're going to worry about mosquito transmission. But then you have to remember that aside from infectious disease hazards, we have lots of chemical refineries on the Gulf Coast. You know, we're a Superfund site. Therefore, you have to worry about long-term effects of chemical exposures. So we're going to have to monitor things like cancer rates along the Gulf Coast. So we're going to have to be monitoring this for decades.
Do you think that given the unprecedented nature of all of these storms, that in a year or 2 years or 5 years, will we know more about how natural disasters affect health and the spread of disease than we do now?
There's no question we're going to be on a steep learning curve after these three storms. And it's by necessity because everything that we're hearing regarding climate change and global warming suggests to us that these three storms are not going to be a one-off entity. And we're just going to have to get really good at this because I don't see these types of catastrophic weather events disappearing any time over the next few decades.
All right. Peter, thanks a lot for your time and for your insights on this. I appreciate it.
Sure, my pleasure.
Dr. Peter Hotez is Dean of the National School of Tropical Medicine at Baylor College of Medicine in Houston.
Good Monday morning. You're listening to the show. Now we're going to check in with the editorial board of the Arizona Republic. It's a regular segment where we talk about the big issues facing the state and the region, featured in the newspaper's viewpoint section. The paper and its partners in the USA Today network just finished a lengthy series on President Trump's proposal to build a new extended wall along the U.S.-Mexico border. A recent column argues that for the U.S. to truly effectively construct a wall, it should look to Israel. With me to talk about that and some of the specifics is Phil Boas, director of the Republic's editorial department. Phil, when did Israel turn to more fencing, and what can the U.S. learn from what that nation did?
So Israel faced a real problem with infiltration from Palestinian terrorists, and they were seeing a lot of death. This was after 2000, after the second Intifada. You would see it was a common story in Israel where a terrorist would get on a bus and basically blow himself up and take everybody out inside that bus as well. And they were really heartbreaking photos coming out of that part of the world at that time. So much carnage. And so Israel started building a fence. They called it a fence. The Palestinians called it a wall. And it was very controversial at the time. We had an Arizona citizen who is also an Israeli who served in the Israeli Defense Forces write a piece for us comparing the fence in Israel, the wall in Israel, to what we might be trying to do here in the United States. And the big takeaway for him was, one, fences work, and two, they're less expensive than you realize.
A lot of members of Congress have talked about, okay, there really should be more of a virtual fence in the U.S. because technology is a big thing, not a wall that Janet Napolitano used to joke about. Well, if you build a 20-foot wall, they'll find a 21-foot ladder, that sort of thing. So how much of a deal would technology be based on what the writer said?
I'll just say, as an institution, we oppose the building of a 2,000-mile border wall. We don't think that that should be done in the United States. We think it's a waste of money. And it's also coming at a time when illegal immigration is down to a trickle. And we may not ever again see the kinds of waves of illegal immigration that we saw over the last 25 years. That may never happen again in this country. So it could be an enormous waste of money if we spend billions to build that. But yes, the Israelis are using technology. One of the ways that the drug smugglers in Mexico get underneath our barriers that we have, I think roughly 700 miles of barrier, they tunnel under it. And the Israelis are coming up with ways to detect these tunnels and destroy them. They're getting better at doing that. And the Israelis have been very successful at cutting off terrorism and terror strikes of this kind that were these incursions over the border.
How big a deal is illegal undocumented immigration in Israel? And has this made a difference there as well?
That has not been the issue in Israel. The issue in Israel is national security, and it's been terrorism. It's been a territory on your border where for decades they have taught their children that Israelis are dogs and pigs. They've taught their children to hate the Israelis, and they grow up as many of them turn into militants who are willing to kill Israelis and Jews. And so they felt it had gotten so bad that it was time they had to actually cut themselves off from that population that wants to destroy them. And the news is that they were effective in doing that. And they did it largely with chain link, double chain link, and with roads that allowed Israeli soldiers to get there quickly whenever they detected movement. And so the only point there, and we were looking at this in an objective way, is that, yes, you can do this and stop human movement.
One argument that comes up is whether it affects the freedom of those even in your home country. Israeli airline is always cited as this is the airline to follow in terms of security and at the airports and whatnot. But then other people argue, well, in America, we don't want that because we want to be able to be freer. What do you make of that overall?
I think there are a lot of lessons to learn from the Israelis. They're in a very tough neighborhood, and the world is getting dangerous, and we're beginning to see the kinds of things that the Israelis started seeing 50 years ago. I mean, we weren't dealing with, you know, radical Islamic terrorism until just shortly before 2001. And now we're very familiar with it. And at that moment then, we were starting to learn lessons from the Israelis because the world had gotten very small.
Do we have a national security issue or potentially on the cusp of one based on what goes on at the southern border? Certainly President Trump, when he was a candidate, brought that up a lot.
It's a real issue. I mean, it's something that we have to be concerned about. We have enemies out there who have weapons of mass destruction, and will they ultimately miniaturize them in a way that they can get them over here? That's a real possibility. But a 2,000-mile border wall isn't going to solve that problem. It won't. I mean, we're going to have to come up with ways to secure the nation, but a static wall is not going to do it. We will need technology, and we'll need human intelligence, probably even more importantly, so that we can stop these kinds of things.
Phil Boas is director of the Arizona Republic's editorial department. Good morning. You're listening to the show on KJZZ 91.5. An update on the latest news from Las Vegas. A gunman identified as 64-year-old Stephen Paddock unleashed the deadliest mass shooting in modern U.S. history last night. From the 32nd floor of a Las Vegas hotel casino, he shot at an outdoor country music festival below, killing at least 58 people. At least 515 others were injured in the Sunday night attack, according to authorities. SWAT teams using explosives stormed the gunman's hotel room and found he had killed himself. Paddock had as many as 10 guns with him, including rifles. Sheriff Joseph Lombardo said a check of federal and state databases showed Paddock was not on law enforcement authorities' radar before the shootings. Aaron Rouse, the FBI agent in charge in Las Vegas, said investigators saw no immediate evidence connecting it to an international terror organization, despite a claim of responsibility from the Islamic State group. The sheriff said authorities believe it was a lone wolf attack. In an address to the country this morning, President Donald Trump called the attack an act of pure evil and added that he would order flags flown at half staff.
That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.